conversations like around, so, you know, Carnegie Hall basically, you know, deciding to claim Carnegie Hall and put it on this map. Like Daughters of Bilitis, where that meeting place was, sure. But Carnegie Hall, Apollo Theater, you know, what were the conversations like around those more significant places that have a more well-documented history?
I think it was that we felt that there were lots of gay, you know, people associated with, you know, it was claiming our rightful place in the history of music. In some cases, it was that you thought you knew that people were gay, but then documenting it was sometimes a problem. I know what I started doing was just reading lots of biographies. I don't know what other people were doing, but so. So I guess you wouldn't, you know, people would, you sort of knew that there were some gay associations with the Chelsea Hotel, but then as I, that was one of my entries, and as I started researching it, there was more and more stuff.
And it seems like there's a, I don't know, surprising to me, a surprising, surprisingly good balance between sites that are lesbian history, representing that history, and then also representing spaces that were more about the male, gay male community. You know, I mean, that struck me as surprising. Let's say that it wasn't overly slanted towards men's history. So, you know, can you correct me if I'm wrong, or, you know, tell me about what those discussions were like? How did you strike that balance?
Well, we had three women writing entries. So that already meant that we were going to have a certain amount of women's history. It was sort of at a period when Blanche Wiesenkoek was publishing the stuff about Eleanor Roosevelt. So we ended up with a lot of Eleanor Roosevelt associations, more than we might have now, just because that was coming out and new. It's also that Andrew Gokart has been a friend of George Chauncey's for all these years. So we had access to some of George's research, and that informed what we were doing.
His book had come out, I can't remember if it was the late 80s or if it was right around this time. And
yeah, so I think there might have been striving to have women's stuff represented, but I don't know if it, you know, it was that much of that we had to do that much conscious thinking about it, that we were going to do it. I'm the one that came up with the daughter of blindest sight, and now I realize that that was sort of a minor sight, but it was like I went through the lesbian Her Story archives, and that's, you know, I found something that had an address. It's like, it's still, the major problem is finding actual addresses for things.
Yeah. And I guess, can you remember, like, looking at the map for the first time and getting a sense of the place-based history of gay people in New York?
I don't know quite how to answer that.
Well, let me ask it this way. You can answer it how, what feels, you know, accurate for you. What was the impact of creating the map?
A sense of accomplishment. It was great to have it. It, when the map came out, it sort of like didn't come out, and it didn't get the distribution that we had hoped for, because it didn't get printed until really late in the game, and so it didn't get circulated in the way we would have. Though, you know, now I realize that, you know, it did eventually get out, but we, but still, it was, it was exciting, and, you know, a feeling of accomplishment to have done that, and, you know, and then it was something that you could share with people, that, you know, as the directors of research at the Lammers Commission changed, each one got a copy of the map, you know, so that it was something that could get people to start thinking about this. Yeah, and we were all really pleased with ourselves that we had accomplished it, and, you know, I still feel that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
25.
Jay,
yeah.
Jay, in his interview, said, you know, we literally now say this was the first effort in the entire United States to do an LGBT place-based history project. Do you agree with that? Does that sound accurate?
Mm-hmm. I guess he's much more aware of, you know, how we fit into the broader context than I am. So if he says so, I believe it. Because, you know, they were beginning efforts at LGBT history, but I don't know how much had been accomplished at that point.
And you're simultaneously working on the nomination for Stonewall.
Mm-hmm.
So, can you tell me how that played out?
Well, it didn't play out that, you know. I worked on it with one other person who was working in LPC and somebody else that was had been a former staff member that was then working someplace else. And we went to talk to the proprietor of the bar that was there then, who was enthusiastic. He talked about, you know, it was sort of like, who was the owner of the building, the estate of Manny Duell? Would they be in favor? And it became, well, it seemed like there was a roadblock there. And then, of course, it seemed that the Park Service also, I did submitted the original sort of nomination to Bill Bolger, who I had been the person that had shepherded through the African burial ground. So it was sort of like, he had given me information on, you know, sort of other cultural historical sites, had talked with me about sites that were less than 50 years old. So, you know, he said that one of the analogies was to the things with the space program, where you knew only a few years later what were the significant sites. And so he initially didn't think that the 50-year thing was going to be that much of a problem. I sent a copy of Martin Duberman's book with the nomination, so that there was already, you know, a body of scholarship that the Park Service could have looked at. I think that on the other hand, we sort of knew that, you know, this was politically a hot potato. We, you know, when you look back, you know, this was the age of Jesse Helms and all that stuff. And so that, but I don't know, I guess maybe I was naive. Still, I thought, you know, that the Clinton administration would take more of a chance on it than they did. But the problems with the estate not welcoming this were, I think it was like they just wouldn't meet with us, let alone, you know, they did not see any reason why they would want this. So then,
yeah.
You know, the geniuses that decided that to incorporate the area around so that, you know, you can get over the problems of owner consent. My hat's off to them.
Well, I'm impressed that knowing that it was a hot potato and that the estate wasn't interested and that no site had been added to the register for gay and lesbian history, I'm impressed that you did it anyway. You submitted the nomination.
Well, at that point, I guess I didn't know it was going to be a no.
Mm-hmm.
And we started trying to get signatures on a petition, which I don't know what happened to all the petitions in James Colgate's closet for quite a long, many years. I can remember. Joan, we were, Olgad was marching in the gay pride, one of the parades. And Joan Berkowitz going up to RuPaul and asking RuPaul to sign. The Indigo guy, real
sign. Oh my gosh. Yeah, the petition might be a historic document.
Pretty upset. Flabbergasted about that. That there was no acknowledgement of the importance of Stonewall. That I thought I had done a fairly good job of explaining its significance, that there was the Duperman book, that, you know, and this just seemed like already an uncontestable fact that it was of overwhelming significance, recognized as being of overwhelming significance to the gay and lesbian community. But, you know, it was sort of like so, yeah, it was just sort of a slap and disappointing.
And I think there's some debate among the LGBT historic sites crew whether the letter was kind of outwardly homophobic or more of a, you know, what are we gonna do about it? We can't do anything. Our hands are tied. Kind of a response. Do you have a position on that?
At the time, I thought it was homophobic. It's hard to look, you know, it's hard to go back in time through the culture wars and they certainly, you know, I'm now more aware of how really bad they were. When you think of all that, of don't ask, don't tell, and how, you know, the people in the Clinton administration and Barney Frank thought that they were doing a step forward. And how bad that was. I think, you know, you have to look at it in that context of
easier to see the violence of it with distance than it was to see at the time.
Well, I don't know, you know, it happened, I put it behind me, we went on, and you mixed up, you know, there's been certainly a lot of progress since then, but.
Now, when you nominated the Stonewall a second time, can you tell me about that experience?
Well, I wasn't so much involved with that. It's sort of like, you know, Jay, sort of the one that's recorded the history of that, it's sort of like the pressure came from on high down to the state, and the state contacted Andrew Dockhart. And I guess Andrew contacted Jay. We all went out to lunch. We may have gone to lunch again, because there was a lunch where Andrew brought David Carter to lunch, and they were going to start working on this. My mother it was sort of like, my parents had been divorced. My mother had remarried, her husband had died. My mother had had a stroke, and I was in the position that she was in a nursing home, and I was going to the nursing home every night. So I wasn't really able to work on the second nomination. My name's on the nomination form, but it's like, I didn't really have much to do with at all with doing the nomination. I did a little bit of research at the end, but I really didn't work on it the second.
Do you think that your nomination in 1994 influenced the...
Well, I didn't I didn't even fill out a nomination form. I did sort of like a nominating letter that sort of, so I hadn't even done a nomination form. Andrew and Jay wrote the nomination. It's mm-hmm. their baby.
And do you think that the openness to accepting the site onto the National Register, what had changed in those few years to make a site like Stonewall desirable to the National Park Service, or would make them consider recognizing its history?
Well, first there was the big political change in that the Clinton administration was on its way out, so that they were doing something at the end that they could do, and didn't, you know, have to, you know, it was sort of like the liberal forces managed to push for something, and they could do it then because they didn't have to run for office a second time. So they took advantage of the situation. And I think that in the intervening years, there had been a little more acceptance, but it was just the ability to do it. And then the idea that you would include the streets, and that, you know, David Carter had done all this research, and that you could incorporate that battle for the streets, made it a much richer story in a way.
And my understanding is that borrowed from the policy used for Civil War battlefields, is that right? Do you think it was a similar situation with Stonewall being named a national monument in 2016? Obama's on his way out, can push it through? or do you think there were other forces, I guess, that made its acceptance as a national monument inevitable or acceptable?
Well, I think there was, Obama was on his way out, but I think there was, but I think there had been all these moves up to that. Thank you, Joe Biden. Thank you, Supreme Court. Thank you, Modern Family, and all the all the things that had happened in those 25 years that were positive. And then it was also, it made a difference that the building was also already individually designated, because then the owners of the building didn't have anything to lose and didn't have something to gain by its being a national monument, you know, and all that stuff. They had already lost their ability to change the appearance of the building, even though, God, like a year after it was designated, they started doing all this work on it. And are you aware of how they started doing all these bad alterations where they were chipping up off bricks and stuff like that and not matching the brick color? Which, and so it was sort of like they had to be stopped. And, you know, it was, perhaps unfortunate that the commissioners had talked so much about its significant historical and cultural significance, and that this is in a pretty building. So then the owners sort of probably thought they had carte blanche to change the facade. But you don't really want to change the facade. You're historical. You want it to look the way it looks. Don't take down the parapet.
How did Stonewall getting, you know, added to the National Register and that history, you know, gaining recognition, how did that change your work at the commission? You know, I'm thinking of the Lundy brothers footnote. You know, did you find that things had changed?
Well, they changed gradually over the years, because I got to sort of incorporate gay and lesbian history more openly as our designations went along. So that one of the ones that I did was a house in Staten Island, where the second owner was an opera singer who was gay, and got to pretty much openly say in the body of the text that he left the house to his partner of whatever number of years. Then there was another hotels in Staten Island where the two men that own it together are lovers. They're both Episcopalian priests. I got to openly write about their relationship. And then sort of like Jay got to write about gay and lesbian history in the South Village for the South Village Historic District Report. And towards the end, we actually had this subcommittee on gay and lesbian sites, and we did sort of those PowerPoint shows that were precursors to the website.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm interested in hearing more about the LGBT Historic Sites Project.
Well, it was sort of like periodically the commission talks about doing historical cultural designations, and then there'll be the, well, we don't know how to regulate them, fight. And but in that particular moment, they thought they'd create some subcommittees and look at areas that had not been addressed. And so they, and then they set up a couple of subcommittees. So there was Black history, and there was LGBT, and there was women's history. Those were sort of like the main ones. And so these various groups then were tasked with coming up with potential sites. And so we started creating lists of potential landmarks based on having done this history. Each time you get a new commissioner, they'll say, we don't know how to do regulate these things. And then the staff will say, well, you could use the Secretary of Interior's standards criteria. You're not inventing something new. People have thought about how to deal with these for 50 years. Oh, we don't know how to do this.
Good news.
So, I think I wandered off of, what was your question?
Well, I was asking about the origins of the LGBT Historic Sites Project, so it sounds like its origins were in the commission, actually, as a committee.
Yes.
And then how did it branch off to become its own project?
Well, there are two, within the commission, what was within the commission stayed within the commission, though it's sort of like, as people have left, they haven't really reactivated the committees. They've done some, the people that are still there that were involved with these things have done some stuff in terms of trying to address certain things, like women's history for women's suffrage. They've did some stuff, but they haven't. And they've put up some website things. In the meantime, with the LGBT website, it was sort of like, I think mostly it was Kevin Lusbader that, and Jay got interested in pushing historic preservation community into doing more about LGBT history. And I guess we who had been involved with the map had always sort of felt like maybe we wanted to do more. And so Ken sort of got us together to talk about doing more at a certain point. And then he and Jay and Andrew decided that they wanted to create a website. Jay was going to leave the commission. I was there. I was working on Stonewall for the designation report. When they formally were creating the Historic Sites Project. And it was sort of like, I had a discussion with Mark Silberman about participating in the project, and he's the agency counsel. And it was sort of like, I had to decide whether I would do that or I would continue to push for things within the commission for LGBT designations. And I sort of said, well, while I'm here, let me be the voice. But then of course they stopped doing it. It was like, I completed the last PowerPoint thing, and we made recommendations, but Meenakshi Srinivasan, who was the commissioner, chair of the commission, just did not go forward with any of those things. So it was like, I ended up, for the last year I was there, mostly working on backlog items, and it was, you know, didn't matter. I could have been involved from the beginnings. But.
And so how does the, now that all of you who are involved in the LGBT Sites project, the website, are separate from the commission, how do you think that the work of the website feeds back into, influences the ability for these sites to actually get landmark status?
In the commission certainly looks at the website and the research they're doing as they're looking for potentials right? I think the project has a voice, but that the commission is still both has difficulty still in dealing with buildings that are not pretty buildings and doing history, and that sort of other calculation, you know, it's like politics still rules. It is, to me, just incredibly frustrating that they have not seemed to budge about the Whitman House. You know, it's still, and as I'm doing stuff in the outer boroughs, you know, I'm finding stuff in Staten Island, but whether they'll ever get a Staten Island council person to agree to a designation in Staten
Island. Yeah. Just leave it at Alice Austin, I guess, maybe once and done.
Well, and when you, it's interesting, since I've been researching Staten Island stuff, that Alice Austin was a lesbian was certainly not something that came, gained easy recognition on Staten Island. It was quite controversial in the 90s. Though it was sort of like not, there was an advance article that said it's not really news. Anyone?
Now it's just in writing at the house. well, I guess as we are kind of wrapping up here, I guess to reflect a little on the progress that you've made since, you know, in particular since the map, but, you know, even before that.
Well, it's been fascinating and fun. It's certainly gratifying that there's this interest, that, and that there's this acceptance of this kind of history, which there wasn't, I think, when we were starting out. Certainly. It's been exciting and interesting.
Mm-hmm. I think by doing all this research, you've really added to a broader understanding of the, particularly the places where this community is able to grow and connect. And is there anything about the research that you've done for the LGBT sites project that you want to, from the outer boroughs, that you want to add here? Anything particularly exciting that you uncovered? I mean, I read through your the reports that you'd written on the site where your name was attached to them, and I think every single one of them almost was new to me, new information, sites and people that I hadn't heard of before. And significant, I learned a significant amount from the research that you've done, I'll put it that way, and I think it's not just me,
well,
who already knows quite a bit about this history. It's
And I'm still learning stuff. One of the people I'm researching now is Michelle Cliff. Have you ever heard of her? She was born in Jamaica of mixed race. And then grew up for some years on Staten Island, where her parents sort of moved and passed as white. Then they went back to Jamaica. Then she graduated from Curtis High School, went to Wagner, got a PhD in art history at the Warburg in London. And then was working as an editor in New York for a while. Met Audrey and Rich, and then they sort of went off together, and she became a writer and editor and a college professor. And wrote novels based on her childhood in Jamaica at first, and then short stories that are sort of grounded in her youth on Staten Island. A wonderful writer that I had never, ever heard of. And, you know, a fascinating history. And so, yeah, it's really exciting discovery. And so I find, you know, this a wonderful retirement.
Certainly earned a PhD in after all these years of original research, I think. Is there anything else that you'd like to add that we didn't get to talk about?
I think that's it.
Okay.
So, is it shut off?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. And there's actually something I want to share with you, but I didn't.